Simon & Schuster Audio presents Field Notes from a Catastrophe: Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Colbert. Read by Hope Davis, with an introduction by the author.
On August 23, 2005, a tropical depression, the 12th of the season, developed in the southeastern Bahamas. The following day, it was upgraded to a tropical storm and given a name, Katrina. The storm continued to gain strength as it moved slowly north and then west, becoming a Category 1 hurricane on August 25th and a Category 5 hurricane, the highest possible designation, on August 28th. Katrina struck New Orleans on August 29th, packing winds of over 100 miles an hour and producing a storm surge that breached the levees protecting the city. The result, as the world soon learned, was a catastrophe. More than 1,000 people died, hundreds of thousands were displaced, and tens of billions of dollars worth of property was destroyed. Just a few weeks before Katrina struck, Kerry Emanuel, a climate scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, published a study on the relationship between hurricanes and global warming. Hurricanes draw their energy from the warm surface waters of the ocean, and most climate models predict that as sea surface temperatures rise, hurricanes will increase in intensity. Emanuel's study showed that not only was hurricane strength likely to grow in the future, it had already increased, right in line with rising sea surface temperatures. Just a few weeks after Katrina, a second group of scientists published a study using an entirely different set of data. It also concluded that hurricane intensity had risen in recent decades. Shortly after that study was published, a second storm, Hurricane Rita, briefly reached Category 5 strength before slamming into the Texas coast near the Louisiana border. The storm had intensified as it passed over the Gulf of Mexico, where water temperatures were significantly higher than normal. It was the first time in the historical record that two storms in the Gulf had reached Category 5 in the same season. In early October, I went down to Louisiana to see what Katrina and Rita had wrought. At that point, the weather was clear and hot. Although more than a month had passed since it was flooded, New Orleans was still almost entirely empty, a modern ghost town with garbage skittering down the streets. On the sides of the vacant houses, rescue workers had scrawled grim notations, "One dog," or "Dead cat." Further south, the devastation was even more grotesque. In Plaquemines Parish, which stretches south and east of the city, whole towns had been reduced to piles of rubble. At one point, I had to take a detour off the main road because two huge fishing boats, washed on shore by the waves, were blocking both lanes. Further on, I saw a dead cow hanging in a tree. No single storm, or even pair of storms, can be said to have been caused by global warming. Weather events are a function of both factors that can be identified and predicted, and of factors that are stochastic, or purely random. But the fact that global warming is making severe storms more frequent means that disasters like Katrina and Rita will, in the coming years, become increasingly commonplace. Jan Egeland, the Emergency Relief Coordinator for the United Nations, called the hurricanes a wake-up call for everybody, and he was right. The question now is, will that call be heeded? The language of science is metric. However, most Americans speak and think in units like feet, miles, and degrees Fahrenheit. I have used English units where practical and metric units where it seemed clearly more appropriate. For instance, the standard measure of carbon emissions is metric tons. A metric ton weighs 2,205 pounds. Preface. There isn't much to do at the Hotel Arctic except watch the icebergs flow by. The hotel is located in the town of Ilulissat on the west coast of Greenland, 4 degrees north of the Arctic Circle. The icebergs originate some 50 miles away at the end of a long and fast-moving ice stream known as the Jakobshafen Isbrae. They drift down a fjord and through a wide-mouthed bay and, if they last long enough, end up in the North Atlantic. It is likely that the iceberg encountered by the Titanic followed this route. To the tourists who visit the Hotel Arctic, the icebergs are a thrilling sight, beautiful and terrible in equal measure. They are a reminder of the immensity of nature and the smallness of man. To the people who spend more time in Ilulissat, native Greenlanders, European tour guides, American scientists, the icebergs have come to acquire a different significance. Since the late 1990s, the Jakobshavn Isbray has doubled its speed. In the process, the height of the ice stream has been dropping by up to 50 feet a year, and the calving front has retreated by several miles. What locals now notice about the icebergs is not their power or immensity, though they are still powerful and immense, but a disquieting diminishment. "You don't get the big icebergs anymore," an Ilulissat town councilman named Jeremiah Stenson told me. We were having coffee on a late spring afternoon in the Hotel Arctic lobby. Outside, it was foggy, and the icebergs seemed to be rising up out of the mist. "It's very strange the last few years. You can see a lot of strange changes." This is a book about watching the world change. It grew out of three articles that I wrote for The New Yorker magazine, which ran in the spring of 2005, and its goal remains much the same as that of the original series: to convey as vividly as possible the reality of global warming. The opening chapters are set near or above the Arctic Circle, in Dead Horse, Alaska, in the countryside outside Reykjavik, at Swiss Camp, a research station on the Greenland ice sheet. I went to these particular places for all the usual journalistic reasons: because someone invited me to tag along on an expedition, because someone let me hitch a ride on a helicopter, because someone sounded interesting over the telephone. The same is true of the choices that were made in subsequent chapters, whether it was a decision to track butterflies in northern England or to visit floating houses in the Netherlands. Such is the impact of global warming that I could have gone to hundreds, if not thousands, of other places, from Siberia to the Austrian Alps to the Great Barrier Reef to the South African Finbus, to document its effects. These alternate choices would have resulted in an account very different in its details, but not in its conclusions. Humans aren't the first species to alter the atmosphere. That distinction belongs to early bacteria, which, some 2 billion years ago, invented photosynthesis. But we are the first species to be in a position to understand what we are doing. Computer models of the Earth's climate suggest that a critical threshold is approaching. Crossing over it will be easy, crossing back quite likely impossible. The second part of this book explores the complicated relationship between the science and the politics of global warming, between what we know and what we refuse to know. My hope is that everyone will listen to this book, by which I mean not only those who follow the latest news about the climate, but also those who prefer to skip over it. For better or, mostly for worse, global warming is all about scale, and the sheer number of figures involved can be daunting. I've tried to offer what is essential without oversimplifying. Similarly, I have tried to keep the discussion of scientific theory to a minimum while offering a full enough account to convey what is truly at stake.
Part 1. Nature. Chapter 1. Shishmaref, Alaska. The Alaskan village of Shishmaref sits on an island known as Sarachev, 5 miles off the coast of the Seward Peninsula. Sarachev is a small island, no more than a quarter of a mile across and 2.5 miles long, and Shishmaref is basically the only thing on it. To the north is the Chukchi Sea, and in every other direction lies the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve, which probably ranks as one of the least visited national parks in the country. During the last ice age, the land bridge, exposed by a drop in sea levels of more than 300 feet, grew to be nearly 1,000 miles wide. The preserve occupies that part of it which, after more than 10,000 years of warmth, still remains above water. Shishmaref, population 591, is an Inupiat village, and it has been inhabited, at least on a seasonal basis, for several centuries. As in many native villages in Alaska,
Life there combines, often disconcertingly, the very ancient and the totally modern. Almost everyone in Shishmaref still lives off subsistence hunting, primarily for bearded seals, but also for walrus, moose, rabbits, and migrating birds. When I visited the village one day in April, the spring thaw was underway and the seal hunting season was about to begin. Wandering around, I almost tripped over the remnants of the previous year's catch emerging from storage under the snow. At noon, the village's transportation planner, Tony Weiwana, invited me to his house for lunch. In the living room, an enormous television set tuned to the local public access station was playing a rock soundtrack. Messages like, "Happy birthday to the following elders," kept scrolling across the screen. Traditionally, the men in Shishmaref hunted for seals by driving out over the sea ice with dog sleds or, more recently, on snowmobiles. After they hauled the seals back to the village, the women would skin and cure them, a process that takes several weeks. In the early 1990s, the hunters began to notice that the sea ice was changing. Although the claim that the Eskimos have 100 words for snow is an exaggeration, the Inupiat make distinctions among different types of ice, including Sikuliak, young ice, Sari, pack ice, and Tuvok, landlocked ice. The ice was starting to form later in the fall and also to break up earlier in the spring. Once it had been possible to drive out 20 miles. Now, by the time the seals arrived, the ice was mushy half that distance from shore. Weiwana described it as having the consistency of a slush puppy. "When you encounter it," he said, "your hair starts sticking up, your eyes are wide open, you can't even blink." It became too dangerous to hunt using snowmobiles, and the men switched to boats. Soon, the changes in sea ice brought other problems. At its highest point, Shishmaref is only 22 feet above sea level, and the houses, most of which were built by the U.S. government, are small, boxy, and not particularly sturdy-looking. When the Chukchi Sea froze early, the layer of ice protected the village the way a tarp prevents a swimming pool from getting roiled by the wind. When the sea started to freeze later, Shishmaref became more vulnerable to storm surges. A storm in October 1997 scoured away a 125-foot-wide strip from the town's northern edge. Several houses were destroyed, and more than a dozen had to be relocated. During another storm, in October 2001, the village was threatened by 12-foot waves. In the summer of 2002, residents of Shishmaref voted, 161-20, to move the entire village to the mainland. In 2004, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers completed a survey of possible sites. Most of the spots that are being considered for a new village are in areas nearly as remote as Sarachev, with no roads or nearby cities or even settlements. It is estimated that a full relocation would cost the U.S. government $180 million. People I spoke to in Shishmaref expressed divided emotions about the proposed move. Some worried that by leaving the tiny island, they would give up their connection to the sea and become lost. "It makes me feel lonely," one woman said. Others seemed excited by the prospect of gaining certain conveniences like running water that Shishmaref lacks. Everyone seemed to agree, though, that the village's situation, already dire, was only going to get worse. Morris Kiotelik, who is 65, has lived in Shishmaref almost all his life. His last name, he told me, means without a wooden spoon. I spoke to him while I was hanging around the basement of the village church, which also serves as the unofficial headquarters for a group called the Shishmaref Erosion and Relocation Coalition. "The first time I heard about global warming, I thought, I don't believe those Japanese," Kiotelik told me. "Well, they had some good scientists, and it's become true." The National Academy of Sciences undertook its first major study of global warming in 1979. At that point, climate modeling was still in its infancy, and only a few groups, one led by Sekiro Manabe at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and another by James Hansen at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, had considered in any detail the effects of adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Still, the results of their work were alarming enough that President Jimmy Carter called on the Academy to investigate. A 9-member panel was appointed. It was led by the distinguished meteorologist Jule Charney of MIT, who, in the 1940s, had been the first meteorologist to demonstrate that numerical weather forecasting was feasible. The Ad Hoc Study Group on Carbon Dioxide and Climate, or the Charney Panel as it became known, met for 5 days at the National Academy of Sciences Summer Study Center in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Its conclusions were unequivocal. Panel members had looked for flaws in the modeler's work, but had been unable to find any. If carbon dioxide continues to increase, the study group finds no reason to doubt that climate changes will result and no reason to believe that these changes will be negligible, the scientists wrote. For a doubling of CO2 from pre-industrial levels, they put the likely global temperature rise at between 2.5 and 8 degrees Fahrenheit. The panel members weren't sure how long it would take for changes already set in motion to become manifest, mainly because the climate system has a built-in time delay. The effect of adding CO2 to the atmosphere is to throw the Earth out of energy balance. In order for balance to be restored, as according to the laws of physics it eventually must be, the entire planet has to heat up, including the oceans, a process, the Charney panel noted, that could take several decades. Thus, what might seem like the most conservative approach, waiting for evidence of warming to make sure the models were accurate, actually amounted to the riskiest possible strategy. We may not be given a warning until the CO2 loading is such that an appreciable climate change is inevitable. It is now more than 25 years since the Charney panel issued its report. And in that period, Americans have been alerted to the dangers of global warming so many times that reproducing even a small fraction of these warnings would fill several volumes. Indeed, entire books have been written just on the history of efforts to draw attention to the problem. Since the Charney Report, the National Academy of Sciences alone has produced nearly 200 more studies on the subject, including, to name just a few, Radiative Forcing of Climate Change, Understanding Climate Change Feedbacks, and Policy Implications of Greenhouse Warming. During the same period, worldwide carbon dioxide emissions have continued to increase, from 5 billion to 7 billion metric tons a year, and the Earth's temperature, much as predicted by Manabe's and Hansen's models, has steadily risen. The year 1990 was the warmest year on record until 1991, which was equally hot. Almost every subsequent year has been warmer still. As of this writing, 1998 ranks as the hottest year since the instrumental temperature record began, but it is closely followed by 2002 and 2003, which are tied for second, 2001, which is third, and 2004, which is fourth. Since climate is innately changeable, it's difficult to say when exactly in this sequence natural variation could be ruled out as the sole cause. The American Geophysical Union, one of the nation's largest and most respected scientific organizations, decided in 2003 that the matter had been settled. At the group's annual meeting that year, it issued a consensus statement declaring, "Natural influences cannot explain the rapid increase in global near-surface temperatures." As best as can be determined, the world is now warmer than it has been at any point in the last 2 millennia. And if current trends continue, by the end of the century, it will likely be hotter than at any point in the last 2 million years. In the same way that global warming has gradually ceased to be merely a theory, so, too, its impacts are no longer just hypothetical. Nearly every major glacier in the world is shrinking. Those in Glacier National Park are retreating so quickly, it has been estimated that they will vanish entirely by 2030. The oceans are becoming not just warmer, but more acidic. The difference between daytime and nighttime temperatures is diminishing. Animals are shifting their ranges poleward, and plants are blooming days and in some cases weeks earlier than they used to. These are the warning signs that the Charney panel cautioned against waiting for. And while in many parts of the globe they are still subtle enough to be overlooked, in others they can no longer be ignored. As it happens, the most dramatic changes are occurring in those places like Shishmaref, where the fewest people tend to live. This disproportionate effect of global warming in the far north was also predicted by early climate models, which forecast, in column after column of Fortran-generated figures, what today can be measured and observed directly. The Arctic is melting. Most of the land in the Arctic, and nearly a quarter of all the land in the Northern Hemisphere, some 5.5 billion acres, is underlaid by zones of permafrost. A few months after I visited Shishmaref, I went back to Alaska to take a trip through the interior of the state with Vladimir Romanovsky, a geophysicist and permafrost expert. I flew into Fairbanks. Romanovsky teaches at the University of Alaska, which has its main campus there. And when I arrived, the whole city was enveloped in a dense haze that looked like fog, but smelled like burning rubber. People kept telling me that I was lucky I hadn't come a couple of weeks earlier, when it had been much worse. Even the dogs were wearing masks, one woman I met said. I must have smiled. I am not joking, she told me. Fairbanks, Alaska's second largest city, is surrounded on all sides by forest, and virtually every summer lightning sets off fires in these forests, which fill the air with smoke for a few days, or, in bad years, weeks. In the summer of 2004, the fires started early, in June, and were still burning 2.5 months later. By the time of my visit, in late August, a record 6.3 million acres, an area roughly the size of New Hampshire, had been incinerated. The severity of the fires was clearly linked to the weather, which had been exceptionally hot and dry. The average summertime temperature in Fairbanks was the highest on record, and the amount of rainfall was the third lowest. On my second day in Fairbanks, Romanovsky picked me up at my hotel for an underground tour of the city. Like most permafrost experts, he is from Russia. The Soviets more or less invented the study of permafrost when they decided to build their gulags in Siberia. A broad man with shaggy brown hair and a square jaw, Romanovsky as a student had had to choose between playing professional hockey and becoming a geophysicist. He had opted for the latter, he told me, because I was a little bit better scientist than hockey player. He went on to earn 2 master's degrees and 2 PhDs. Romanovsky came to get me at 10 a.m. Owing to all the smoke, it looked like dawn. Any piece of ground that has remained frozen for at least 2 years is, by definition, permafrost. In some places, like eastern Siberia, permafrost runs nearly a mile deep. In Alaska, it varies from a couple of 100 feet to a couple of 1,000 feet deep. Fairbanks, which is just below the Arctic Circle, is situated in a region of discontinuous permafrost, meaning that the city is pocked with regions of frozen ground. One of the first stops on Romanovsky's tour was a hole that had opened up in a patch of permafrost not far from his house. It was about 6 feet wide and 5 feet deep. Nearby were the outlines of other, even bigger holes, which, Romanovsky told me, had been filled with gravel by the local public works department. The holes, known as thermokarsts, had appeared suddenly when the permafrost gave way, like a rotting floorboard. The technical term for thawed permafrost is talik, from a Russian word meaning not frozen. Across the road, Romanovsky pointed out a long trench running into the woods. The trench, he explained, had been formed when a wedge of underground ice had melted. The spruce trees that had been growing next to it, or perhaps on top of it, were now listing at odd angles, as if in a gale. Locally, such trees are called drunken. A few of the spruces had fallen over. These are very drunk, Romanovsky said. In Alaska, the ground is riddled with ice wedges that were created during the last glaciation, when the cold earth cracked and the cracks filled with water. The wedges, which can be dozens or even hundreds of feet deep, tended to form in networks, so when they melt, they leave behind connecting diamond or hexagonal-shaped depressions. A few blocks beyond the drunken forest, we came to a house where the front yard showed clear signs of ice wedge melt-off. The owner, trying to make the best of things, had turned the yard into a miniature golf course. Around the corner, Romanovsky pointed out a house no longer occupied that basically had split in two. The main part was leaning to the right and the garage toward the left. The house had been built in the 60s or early 70s. It had survived until almost a decade ago when the permafrost under it started to degrade. Romanovsky's mother-in-law used to own 2 houses on the same block. He had urged her to sell them both. He pointed out one, now under new ownership. Its roof had developed an ominous-looking ripple. When Romanovsky went to buy his own house, He looked only in permafrost-free areas. 10 years ago, nobody cared about permafrost, he told me. Now everybody wants to know. Measurements that Romanofsky and his colleagues at the University of Alaska have made around Fairbanks show that the temperature of permafrost in many places has risen to the point where it is now less than 1 degree below freezing. In places where the permafrost has been disturbed by roads or houses or lawns, much of it is already thawing. Romanofsky has also been monitoring the permafrost on the North Slope and has found that there, too, are regions where the permafrost is very nearly 32 degrees Fahrenheit. While thermokarsts in the roadbeds and talc under the basement are the sort of problems that really only affect the people right near or on top of them, warming permafrost is significant in ways that go far beyond local real estate losses. For one thing, permafrost represents a unique record of long-term temperature trends. For another, it acts, in effect, as a repository for greenhouse gases. As the climate warms, there is a good chance that these gases will be released into the atmosphere, further contributing to global warming. Although the age of permafrost is difficult to determine, Romanofsky estimates that most of it in Alaska probably dates back to the beginning of the last glacial cycle. This means that if it thaws, it will be doing so for the first time in more than 120,000 years. It's really a very interesting time, Romanofsky told me.